Welcome to the 31st episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I am Jesse Gitzman Burke, and co-hosting with me tonight is Jordan Bloody Sunboy Steelman.
Hey, hey, hey.
It's been a while since we've got a formal episode in, so let's get right into it with some news. Jordan, it's been, what, how many weeks?
Mid-April was the last time we got one out.
I think we might be operating on somewhere between 4 and 5 weeks since we last did the formal episode. We did episode 30, which was a review and recap of the Horror of Hugeldal adventure with Chris Wagner, where we kind of explored a new idea for the show where whenever we finish a written adventure that we go back with the GM and all the players and kind of do a post-mortem on it and really just kind of delve into strategy as a GM, how players are evolving, really have some fun, kind of like, hey, what if we had done this differently? What would happen? Have you ever done one of those?
Yeah, that's always good. I mean, I'm one of those people that I'm totally open to feedback. In fact, I really think that it's not a solo effort in any respect for the GM or for the players. It really, the game benefits when people sit down, they kind of talk back and forth, with each other about, what did you enjoy, what did you not enjoy, what do you think could be better, or what would you like to even, what would you like to see in the game? What if we handled things differently? What if we were, more niggly on the rules? What if we were less niggly on the rules? All that kind of stuff is good talk. I think it's good table talk, and it's good to know, get to know your players and how they like to play, get to know your GM and how he likes to run the game.
I kind of figured this show and half of the live adventures that we do are on some level a tutorial on how to role play the way that we do it, which is not necessarily the right way or the best way or anything like that, but it's kind of just another view or an example of play. But also, for those people who maybe can't get a game going, give them the chance to get their Warhammer fix, but also open up avenues for discussion on how this stuff works and what can inspire people. I've learned a ton since we've begun. I think a lot of other people have, found it really useful for different play styles. I have the benefit of talking with Layla after each game where, I get to hear what her character is up to and what she thought of the session, and we'll both, kind of get some banter going back and forth on how things went. But I don't feel everybody always gets that benefit, particularly with the GM, where you can really dive in and say, how did this work out? Did you make that up? That was on the fly? Oh my God, that's so cool.
right.
I mean, there were several instances in the Hugeldal game where we were completely off the rails and we had no idea that we were off the rails. Uh-huh. And I thought that was brilliant.
Uh-huh. I had a GM for a different game, but he introduced me to a concept that was pretty cool. He would take every player aside at the end of the game, and he would say, okay, so, tell me what you think about, what's happening in the game. What does your character think is going on? Where would your character like to go? What would he like to do? Who does he want to confront? How does he want to talk to them? And that was, he kind of made it up to be like, almost like we were trying to get on the same level, but really I know what was happening was that he would listen to us kind of spout out these random ideas about what we thought was happening, and then he would totally take that and then retroactively slap it into his game.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great way to do it. Michael Wilson does that a lot, I think.
Great way to GM.
Yeah, he did that a lot at beginning our adventures to make sure we had plenty of seeds going in, but then even afterwards, as we kind of voice how we think things are unfolding, I can tell he's picked up on a few of the ideas that we've dropped. He had a lot of them on his own already, but some of them got a little more colorful as we got involved.
Yeah, I've always said that the players are much better at hanging themselves than the GM is. So totally give them the rope.
Totally. Well, Heroes Call is finally out. Now, I know this is a little dated from the podcast perspective, but, since we last recorded a formal episode, there's actually been quite a few product releases, most notably Heroes Call. We've covered the product pretty extensively prior to its release, thanks to some of the listeners and participants who were able to, you know, give us an early copy to, not give us one, but discuss an early copy and all of its components. Have you had a chance to pick it up?
I haven't, but you know what? It was just yesterday was my first opportunity to see it in person. I went and stopped at the local game store close to my workplace, and saw it on the shelf for the first time. So of course I had to pick it up, and I you know, pawed over it and looked it over, but my gaming budget just wasn't there right now. I also saw the one of the older print-on-demands, the Sigmarite one. But they were asking a little bit too much for it. I think they were asking more than MSRP, actually. So I decided to pass on that as well. But
The Heroes Call box was. I mean, I think it's one of the best expansions we've seen to date. I mean, I'm thrilled with it. I think the adventure in it, I'm particularly happy with. I'm not really sure how other people are taking it yet. But of course, you've got halflings and ogres, who I really was not very excited about until I got the box. And then all of a sudden, I'm looking at the specifics. All of a sudden, that option is formally available to me, and I am thrilled to play an ogre. I never thought I'd say that. I couldn't have cared less in the past, but now all of a sudden I have a character all ready to go. I've started putting him. I even like seeded him in one of the in our first. Episode of the Harrower of Thanes, so I had them meet him, so in case he shows up later, it makes sense. So maybe that's a good way for you GMs out there who are hoping to play one day, is, you know, use your future PCs as NPCs to get your characters familiar and develop their backstory.
Yeah, actually, that's really great advice, because what you do when you do that, not only, you know, as the GM, do you get the opportunity to kind of bring in these different interesting characters, and hopefully, you know, your PCs will latch onto them and they'll remember them, even if they're not around all the time. But, you know, if they just run into them from time to time, and maybe, you know, they're helpful, they have good information sometimes, or maybe they just give you a good cheap place to sleep, or they come in and beat the beastmen off of you from time to time when your party really needs it. But then that, you know, like you said, it gives the GM the opportunity to bring in a PC at a later time if, you know, you have a group like some do where you rotate GMs with the same party or something. You can introduce a character and not make it feel kind of forced, like, oh, okay, well, we're going to travel with this guy because he's the new PC.
Right.
You know, but, hey, we know this guy, and we would totally travel with him. Sure, why don't you come along?
Excellent.
It's great advice.
Are you familiar much with the adventure that comes in the Heroes Call? Because to me, aside from the two new races, that was the highlight for me.
I don't know anything about it other than the fact that apparently it's a green skin wog. Isn't that true?
So without giving any real spoilers, because I think the basic concept of the adventure is pretty safe to advertise, because I think that really just decides if people are going to be interested in it, but it's an impending law in a region that, and then the players are kind of forced to deal with the preparation of a castle for a siege, and then actually take care of that siege and play out its consequences. But I think that the adventure, it's certainly catered for high ranking characters, probably 4 or 5. For those of you who want to try that adventure for lower level characters, I think it's very easy to adapt it to a lower level group. I mean, certainly not an introductory group, but for ranks 2, maybe rank 3, it could easily be adjusted for that. Just maybe make a couple less bad guys or give your players some more support. But it was a very fun adventure to read. A lot of what makes Warhammer great is in this adventure. The comedy amongst the orcs and how they fight is just hysterical. I found myself laughing out loud at several instances.
That's one of the things I always liked about the Greenskins, and even about the ogres. You're talking about, throwing an ogre into a party. But, both of those, they have their... I mean, they're at their core pretty serious, brutal people, but it's the Warhammer sort of the black humor that coats it, you know, that...
The special rule for the ogres are if they have to eat 5 to 6 times a day, and if at any point they're not eating, they either go into this murderous rampage or they sit down and sulk until somebody feeds them.
Right.
It's kind of at the player's or the GM's discretion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic. They're like a big baby.
Mm-hmm. I like the fact that their magic is called gut magic. I think that's just hilarious. And you know, they believe
power
that, yeah, the source
belly.
Of their power is their stomach, you know.
Well, they can, and they'll eat anything, and then they will pretty much spend all their money they have to eat if they can. You know, that's like the way to go. So anyway, I think I give Heroes Call a good 2 thumbs up. Even for people who do not have high level characters, I think I'd highly encourage it for the new races and the adventure that's very flexible, and you get loads of cool creatures in there and lots of epic enemies, which I really enjoyed.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've been wanting to pick it up.
So, any new news on The Enemy Within?
I have not heard anything in terms of the Fantasy Flight release. I've just kind of seen, again, some more recaps of the, you know, various blog entries and stuff like that, just talking about, you know, speculation about it. But
you know, one thing
anything concrete.
One thing I did notice in as I've been going over the past several months, I've been trying to fully read each of the books that have come in all the modules, and I'm starting to appreciate a bit more how well Fantasy Flight is seeding their adventures together. What I don't mean is like one goes from point A to point B to point C, but that they drop hints of what is going to happen, of what the Heroes Call adventure is about, many, many books prior to its release. They literally say what this adventure is. You just, whether or not you know to pay attention to it, they say it. And
sure.
They've done that on multiple ones now. I was reading through the, I believe it was the Blackfyre Pass book, where they specifically reference the events that are going to take place in The Enemy Within. You know, they talk about the current state of Averland, the noble dying, the Electric Count dying, and the political turmoil, and basically set up the stage for what is to be that adventure. They do that kind of stuff for multiple ones, which got me thinking.
That's interesting.
But where it got me thinking, though, is there's a lot that they have seeded that have not been printed yet that may very well be future adventures.
Sure.
So there's an undead one, there's a vampire counts one, there's one with the wood elves and beastmen and Bretonnia. They're all over, and they've kind of systematically been using each of those to develop the future modules. So I think if you want to kind of look around in those books for those little adventure seeds, a lot of those are coming true.
That's cool. That's pretty astute of you. I have to admit it's been a while since I've gone back and read a lot of those, so I'm sure I'll go back through them again now with a critical eye, and I'm sure I'll kind of pick up on some of that.
I think most of them I've found in where they kind of talk about future or past battles or what's happening in each region. I think there were at least 3 or 4 that were very direct references, just with like down to the point where they mentioned specific names.
Uh-huh.
Like this, the war that takes place in Heroes Call is specifically mentioned by location and the Black Orc who leads it.
Oh, okay.
So it's I don't know. I mean, I don't know how well they have it planned, or if they're just kind of flying by the seat of their pants and connecting dots,
or just retroactively applying.
And it's not a bad thing to do. I mean, that's a great idea.
Oh yeah, totally.
So we actually had 2 other products though released recently. First, we had the Bright Wizard Print on Demand supplement, which was, you know, 20 or 30 some odd cards, giving you 15 new spells all the way up to rank 5 and a couple new new items. That one, and in addition to that, the Shalion print-on-demand supplement with a very similar format and a couple items came out as well. And I actually just got the Faith of Shalia in the mail yesterday. I'm looking at it right here. It's pretty cool. I'm more interested in the item cards than I am all of the new spells that everybody has available.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really excited to see that they are very actively and quickly putting these out, because this would mark the 4th one Or is it the fifth?
Well, yeah, fourth one, can if you count the Dreadfleet captains.
Yeah, so we had Sigmar, Dreadfleet, Bright Mages, and then the Shalions, so it's four. Okay. So that means three of them have been exploring the very specific notion, or the very specific class or career, and then the Dreadfleet one was the only one that really addressed a broad topic. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was going to say one of the the trend that you notice there immediately, especially well as it concerns the Sigmarites, the Bright Wizards, and the Shalion print on demand products. I mean, clearly they're targeting the content that was available in the core set.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Which I naturally just assume that's because they're the most popular.
Yeah, well, and I think that applies in a certain sense as well. I think the reason why those particular groups were selected for the core set is because they're generally the most popular types to play. When you're talking wizards and priests.
So off that point, though, there's been a pretty active topic on the forums where they address just that. What these print on demands are arguably hitting up the most popular ones first. So somebody posed the question: what is, if you have a spellcaster or a priest in your party, who are they? What they were trying to determine, kind of who might be the next one coming if they're kind of continuing to follow this pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So what's been your experience with that? When you ever have a spellcaster, what order and what cult do they come from?
Well, and again, kind of like my thinking for their reasoning for this, aside from maybe just general popularity of these different career types, these different spellcaster types, and it makes sense from a business perspective too, that if you're going to release these supplemental products for specific careers, that really you want to target your broadest audience first.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's going to be, who's coming into Warhammer 3rd and who's going to be considering picking up supplements, they're going to start with the core set, right? So you really want to speak to supporting the content that the largest percentage of the customer base has.
So let's dive into that a little bit. Can you recall off the top of your head who were the three? I think it was three priests and three wizards that were focused on in the core set. We know it was Bright Wizards. We know it was Shalions. Yeah. We know it was Sigmarites. Do we recall what the other ones were?
The other priest casters were
more.
More. Uh-huh. So the next, I'm betting that the next priest pod that we see is going to be for more supporting spells items.
I think I agree with you. I think the next one that we see for priests will be more.
Right.
Part of something in the back of my head says the next print on demand will not be for priests, though. I don't think they'll be stopped for priests.
Yeah, they went. Sigmarites, Bright Wizards, and then Shalions. I'm betting that the next one is going to be a wizardly pact as well. And my I would almost be willing to put money on the fact that I think it's going to be for the Grey Wizards.
Oh, I was going to say gray or celestial.
Yeah, I think gray, just because my tendency in just general experience with Warhammer is that if you've got a person who's going to choose between a gray wizard and a celestial wizard, the average player is probably going to lean toward gray wizard.
I think gray wizard makes more sense. It's just a typical like shadow wizard.
Nicely, like the just like the Sigmarites, pretty well contrast with the Shalions in terms of, what kind of priests they represent. Obviously, the Sigmarites are very heavy-handed and mace in hand, and where the Shalions are obviously about peace and love and joy, and the Bright Wizards are all about destroy, fire, boom, and the the Grey Wizards are all about, sneaking behind and, obfuscation and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would almost be willing to put money that the next pack would be for Grey Wizards. And then after that, probably more, and then Celestial Wizards.
So if you had to pick a print-on-demand that's going to come out that is not a priest or a mage or wizard order, what do you think is a likely candidate? If we were to say that the next one is not, I think it's fair to say the next one's not going to be a priestly order. So it's either going to be another mage order or something else. So what if it's something else? Where's your money on?
That's pretty tough. I mean, it depends whether or not they want to try and strike way out into left field like they did with Dreadfleet Captains, because that was, you know, that was a product that was not in any way kind of what you would think is typical Warhammer Fantasy roleplay.
I think that was also at the beginning where they were very willing just to experiment with what they could get away with. Yeah. Not to mention they needed a Dreadfleet tie-in just to kind of like milk that product a little
bit. Right. I think that's what its purpose was there, was really kind to tie into, you know, the marketing that was going on with Games Workshop and all that, which makes sense.
Now, I'm more curious not what you'd like to see, but what you think the most realistic.
Yeah, right. What's most likely to come out?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's pretty tough.
Do you think we're gonna see anything of like the martial careers or any other kind of like support or social actions? Mm-hmm. Maybe a deck of corruption cards and wound cards.
Item
cards.
I don't honestly think that that's... I wouldn't call that likely, just from my frame of mind. I don't
think
it's likely.
You think the action cards are going to kind of be the staple of the print-on-demand?
Probably, just because those would tend to... those would tend to have kind of the broadest appeal for players to pick up.
I think I'd really like to see... And I think they're kind of at the point where they might try it, doing some cards of the other format, of the other size. For example, you know, like the little half cards, like wounds and all that. I'd like to see them at least show that the capability is there to do those.
Yeah.
That way it opens the door for the future of more content or different types of content, not just the standard card size choices. Because if we continue with this size, we're restricted to item cards, location cards, monster cards. They've already shown they can release creatures, because the Dreadfleet module or the print on demand showed that.
Right.
The only thing we're missing is, you know, talents. We're missing wounds, mutations,
disease,
miscast, disease. But I feel those are all pretty well covered. But at the same time, you know, an option might be neat.
Yeah. I don't know. That's pretty tough. I almost think that they should try. And I think it might not be too unlikely, though I wouldn't expect to see it any time in the immediate future, but I'd like to see kind of creature packs, like a little pack of additional monsters and actions that are all centered around, say, like the undead, like zombies and skeletons and ghouls and ghosts. You know, just kind of extra little pockets of support, like maybe a pack of extra stuff for the Skaven, or, you know, a packet of stuff for the Greenskins or something like that. You know, just general, you know, here's some extra stuff to spiff out your different monsters.
Yeah, you know? For sure. I'd love the monsters and stand-ups. I mean, I'm a little bummed that you don't get that cool cardboard quality with the print-on-demand, but I'm still open to that idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other news, I know a lot of you guys on the Facebook page have seen it, but we did print a copy of the extra super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. I printed it as big as it was economically possible. Jordan, I know you had some questions about it because you were thinking of doing it yourself and you had some friends that were doing it. Let me give you the quick breakdown of what I did, and then let me know your thoughts.
Okay.
So I had maxed it out at the largest size of a JPEG file, which I know is not the easiest deliverable, but that was also the biggest image format that I could find. That was not ridiculously huge, but that was 30,000 pixels wide, which so if you equate that the most high quality color printers will print somewhere in the range of 300 dots per inch, which puts it in the range of, you know, something like 8 to 10 feet wide. So what I did is I went out and looked for a printer a professional printer, because that's not the thing you're going to print at home or at Kinko's.
Yeah.
You're going to want to go to some place that actually, you know, does commercial printing. And they're all over the place. Anyway, I went to one, and it turns out the largest paper size that most anybody can do is on a big roll which is 5 feet tall, and then, you know, 100 or whatever feet long. So you can go as long as you want, but it's maximum width of 5 feet. So I had the option of printing it in two strips, or downsizing the map so that it all fit on 1 5-foot roll. After penciling out how much it would cost to do the two strips, I opted to downsize it. Ultimately, I printed it at 5 feet by about 7.5 or 8 feet. So it stands just about as tall as I do, and it considerably wider than my arm span. It's massive and awesome. I look at it now on the wall, and I don't even know what to do. But, I mean, do you have any questions about it? Because I know we were talking a little bit before the show on kind of what the restrictions were. And
yeah, I have been... I couldn't say maybe racking my brain's not quite apt, but I've definitely been kind of putting my brain to trying to figure out exactly what it would take to print this thing, because I love the map. I mean, it's just this gorgeous, gorgeous map, and I think it would totally make any game room, especially, you know, whether you're running a Warhammer game or not, you know, at the time, it would just totally, you know, make the atmosphere just something to behold. It would just make this awe-inspiring presentation. And so I've wanted to do it, and I've kind of thought about, you know, okay, well, I've seen, you know, some of the giant poster map, you know, print machines, and, you know, I was trying to think, what dimensions can they do, and how could I crop this image to, you know, maybe get it down to a reasonable size? And then, of course, the biggest question that always comes to the forefront of that conversation is, so how much is it going to cost?
So that's a good question. The roll format that I did, I think this was the best option. There was a variety of different paper types available, everything from matte poster paper to you know, high gloss finish like you would do a photo. They all cost about the same. It was $9 a square foot, and that seemed to be kind of the going average. You might find it a little cheaper. I know you'll certainly find it more expensive than that.
Right.
But this was acceptable. And that's per square foot. So if you've got, you know, 5 feet by 7 or 8 feet, you know, that's a lot of square feet.
Yeah,
but ultimately, the one I printed came out to just a hair over $300, which I thought was very acceptable. That was within the price range I was kind of hoping for. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of money for something to print. And then hang on your wall. But, I mean, it's not that much money if you compare it to how much it costs to get a piece of art that big.
Sure.
I thought it was very reasonable. If I were to print the whole thing at its normal resolution in the two strips, that would have been closer to $1,250 plus tax. Because you got to imagine it's twice as wide,
right?
Which means then it's also twice as tall, so it's four times the square footage. I considered that both cost prohibitive, and also I did not have a wall that large.
Uh-huh.
But the downside of actually printing it out was that the even with upping the size of all the names of the locations slightly after downsampling it, they still are somewhat illegible.
Uh-huh.
They're close. I mean, all the big titles look great, but some of the individual names of cities are still pretty hard to read.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little disappointed with that, but at the same time, I mean, it looks amazing, so I can't complain too much. But it's great, like, reading the books and them telling you, you know, these are the different locations, and this is where Chaos invaded here, and the dwarves live here. You can, like, go onto the map and just see it all very organically, and it's really a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
So we can, like, plot our adventures and, like, where our group has gone.
Uh-huh. Yeah, see, that'd be awesome.
You're like, where's that obscure dwarf hold they just referenced? Oh, there it is. Okay, thanks.
And so the map that you printed out, it's the entire map, right? It's the entire
map.
Yep. Well,
yeah, okay. I did the whole thing because I had a really nice, high-quality Warhammer logo in the top right, which looks amazing when that's printed out because it's it puts this great focal point into the Chaos Waste up on top.
Uh-huh.
And adds this extra layer of color to the whole map, which makes it just look real sharp.
Yeah.
See, and the scale is on there and everything. The scale, right, by the way, when you print it out, is going to be wrong, or at least part of it's going to be, because the 1 to 600,000 or whatever ratio, and the 1 inch equals so and so miles. That of course gets distorted when you downsample the map and have it reprinted. That only applies when it's in its full scale in the on the computer.
Yeah, one of the things that I had thought about, and maybe this would be some good further table conversation for later, maybe. But one of the things I considered was, you know, well, trying to tackle this beast of the entire map, maybe it would make for a much easier and cheaper to produce map if I could somehow crop that image to where it was centered mostly on the Empire, you know, but showed enough of sort of Britannia and Kislev and the border princes that, you know, you get a good kind of imperial centric map.
That's very, very possible, because you could, well, what you would do, given that the map I printed is one half the size of the default map, you would, if you were to zoom in to make, zoom in, you know, 50% or whatever, I'm not sure how to say that properly, but if you were to zoom in to twice magnification and print, you would, and still being that large, you'd be at its normal resolution.
Uh-huh.
So you would have to then crop in from there. You could easily get the Empire on like a 4x4 foot page. But that's still 16 feet. That's 16 square feet at $10. That's going to still run you $175, $180 sure. after tax. But that's readily available at places like Kinko's or something.
Right, right. And a 4x4 map is a little easier to find wall space for.
It is. It's, mind you, though, it's also still quite large. It doesn't sound that big when you're just talking about it, but when you put it up on a wall or see it in person, that gets really big. I mean, that's the size of most Warhammer game tables.
Yeah.
The other thing that worth noting was the what to back it with, or if you want to laminate it, or if you want to put like foam core or something like that to back it. That will exponentially increase your costs, especially if it's large, and it'll also limit your ability to transport it. Because, I mean, this thing's 5x7 feet. There's no way I could put a backing on this and still put it in my car. I'd need a U-Haul truck to move it around. So I opted not to do that. If you do something like 4x4 feet, that option might be available to you again. And the last thing was the type of paper. I would suggest against doing anything with a glossy finish, because something that large will have a tremendous amount of reflected light coming off of it, and it'll make it very difficult to read. So I'd go with some kind of matte or semi-matte finish. So I mean, it makes it look older and more antique anyway. So there's easy, nice heavyweight papers that'll do that.
Cool.
Looking at it right now, and I built a frame for it too. It looks really neat. I threw some pictures up on the Facebook page if you guys want to check them out.
Oh, cool. I want it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really thrilled with it. I'd love to print it again like a year or two from now, if it seems right, because there's some things I'd do differently just to kind of make sure it came out a little bit better. But ultimately, I'm pretty pleased.
That's cool.
So other news, we've got KublaCon coming up this weekend, Memorial Day weekend. KublaCon, if you guys recall from last year, is a very large convention, a gaming convention in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's it starts Friday afternoon and goes till Monday afternoon. It's a 24-hour-a-day convention of all types of gaming. So several of us are going to run out down there and have some fun, try and get some Warhammer on, and maybe play a few other games. We might even try and do a podcast from the convention. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to bring this stuff anyway, see if we can find a quiet or reasonably quiet place to do that. So that could be fun. So if anybody is planning on going, make sure and shoot us a message. We'd love to hook up. I know several of the folks from the Horror at Hugeldahl adventure that we play here, and even a few from Michael Wilson's group may be heading down that way. So we'll hopefully get a game on. Are there any big conventions out where you are?
There was actually I missed there's a monthly gaming convention. It's not for role-playing games, though there are the occasional role-playing game played at it, but it's I'm in the Dallas area, so there's a Dallas Games Marathon, which they actually do monthly, and that was last weekend. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go. I had other plans. But there's also another upcoming convention, and I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but it's dedicated primarily to sort of the old school Renaissance crowd. So a lot of the retro clones of, you know, D&D and stuff like that, like Lamentations of the Flame Princess, Swords and Wizardry, Labyrinth Lord, you know, and a lot of those old, you know, AD&D games, but a lot of other games as well. That one is going on I think it's like the second weekend of June. Unfortunately, that happens to exactly coincide with my anniversary weekend, so there's no way that I'm
going to. I mean, really, what I'm hearing is you should just be taking your wife to the gaming convention.
Yes, and if I could pass that off as an anniversary gift, then, you know. but sadly, that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like literally, I think it, well, of course, you know, I think it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And Saturday, of course, is our anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so I might be able to kind of squeak by a couple of hours Friday night after I get off of work, or maybe try and squeeze in Sunday morning. But I was just a little disappointed because all the cool things, all the cool seminars. I mean, there's like real big names like Errol Otis and Jeff D and some real big people in the industry who are going to be there and doing their seminars and even just kind of running games. And Saturday was like the big day for that con, you know, when, mm-hmm. when like Errol Otis and Jeff D were going to be doing like an artist's, you know, discussion board and stuff, you know, like how they design old school artwork and showing off some pieces and stuff. And, but it's just not in the cards for me this year, so I'll have to wait until next year.
Maybe next time. Well, maybe we should just take the weekend off this weekend and come out and come to KublaCon with us.
Yeah.
we'll fly Lester down, fly you out on our you know, reckless dice budget.
Yeah, on your private jet.
That's right, with a money hat that Fantasy Flight fills weekly. other news. We finished up the new character sheet that I'd been working on for some time with a lot of help from the community. You guys have been fantastic helping review that and give me some tips and pointers to help come up with a character sheet that suits both a lot of needs. It is available at Gitzman's Gallery, and also there's some good discussion on it on the Fantasy Flight forums. This is a sheet that I had put out, I want to say, maybe around the beginning of the year. And I'd done the front side, and it was, I built the sheet with the character sheet with the idea that it would help new players understand visually, have everything in front of them, but also understand visually how to build their dice pools based on all their statistics. So it has, you know, dice references for what to, you know, what color dice to pull for this, where, you know, it reminds you, oh, these are yellow dice. These skills are yellow dice. Specializations are white dice. Misfortune dice, high quality, low quality, characteristic dice, things like that. But not only did I finish the front page and make a lot of adjustments to that, I also made the backside, which allows room for diseases, critical wounds, enemies and nemesis, friends, mutations, insanities, notes, drawings, and also the ability to transfer all the information that would be on your career card onto your character sheet, so you can really limit the number of components you need to play. I mean, you could literally play the entire game with just this character sheet and your talents and be pretty well off. So you can have far less stuff on the table at any given time. And also it's laid out where everything you need to play is on the front side, and then all of your kind of bookkeeping materials are on the back side. So there's not a lot of flipping cards over and opening and closing books and all that. And even it does also fold in half and fit nicely into the career boxes.
That's cool.
So I tried to put some good thought into it. I think it looks pretty sharp. I'm pretty happy with it. When I got the big map printed, I had a stack of 20 or 30 of these printed up as well. They're they look real nice. I kind of went on a printing rampage when I got the map. I was like, well, hell, if you guys are going to do this thing, let me have 30 of those. And I also had had them print up a book of Liber Fanatica. Is it 7 or 8? The one with the blue cover. I was cited as providing some map resources and that, so I wanted to have a copy of that. That thing was expensive. I do not suggest doing that, because that was $70 or so dollars to do a full color book of that. And that was, it's very cost ineffective if you're just going to do one or two. If you do like 10 or 50 of them, the economy of scale begins to kick in. But it's just, unless you really, really want one, I would not suggest printing it in color. So I hear there's a online gaming group forming, and we've kind of referenced this a couple times on the show, but I wanted to get you guys some specifics on it. Fenderstadt of the Fantasy Flight forums has a Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition virtual group brewing, where they are getting some tabletop games going via Map Tools and Fantasy Grounds, and they seem to have a pretty active community going there. So have you heard much about this, Jordan?
No, not personally. I mean, just kind of what we've talked about here on the show, no, I'm a bit behind on it.
So they've actually, over the last couple weekends, got a couple games going. They posted some screenshots on the Facebook page and on the forums, and I believe it's a relatively open invitation if you're interested in participating. I'll post a link for who or how to join the group on the show notes. Shoot him over a request; he'll get you in, and then you guys can from all around the world. We have there are people organizing there to get the Map Tools and Fantasy Grounds games going. So I found that it's been a request of the community for quite some time, and I really appreciate that Fenderstadt's putting the effort forth to get that together and organized. Other news, almost done. We completed the Horror at Hugeldahl adventure. That was a blast. Have you played that one yet?
No, but I'm a little behind on the on your guys' podcasting of it, but I was following it the first two episodes.
Mm-hmm. I think our fourth one was the finale. So Chris Wagner, who plays Grom, a dwarf slayer, when he's not doing the GM, being the GM, we don't have that kind of relationship. He did a fantastic job. I highly encourage anybody who enjoys the live play sessions to listen to those. That gave me a chance to be a player, which I have yet to do. That was the first time I've been a player in a. It's the second time because of Michael Wilson's games. But it was a blast. We had a great time. One of my favorite adventures. I say that of all of them, though, I really haven't had a bad time in any of the games that we've done so far. They've all been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But that then brought us into our new adventure, which we've kicked off last week. We posted the first installment of it. We decided to do the Harrower of Thanes, which is the adventure that comes in Blackfyre Pass.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had a chance to read that one, or are you familiar with that?
I've read a bit into it, but I wanted to wait because I wasn't sure if somebody else was going to. At the time, there was somebody else who was potentially going to be running that adventure, and I didn't want to spoil it. I have something of a penchant for the dwarfs, so I'm hoping that one turns out to be a good adventure because I like dwarfs. So any adventure that kind of focuses on them is I like to explore. I might use that one actually sort of an in-between adventure for my current campaign, my Enemy Within campaign, because I have two dwarfs in the party. Uh-huh. And they're on their way towards a dwarf Carrick, and so I'm looking for some inspiration for having an actual adventure at the Carrick.
Oh, cool. Well, we had a lot of fun getting. I mean, I hadn't been a GM for the better part of 2 or 3 months, so I kind of had to get myself kickstarted back into being a GM from a player. But we had a lot of fun with our opening adventure, and I think had one of the more memorable experiences for myself as a GM, where I decided to go all in and do a first person NPC character that they met, accent and everything, like kind of all out there, and had a blast. There's this nobleman named Theodosius von Tuchtenhagen,
Oh, I love it.
And he's got, I mean, I don't, none of this is really spoilers. I'm just kind of lay out his personality, but he's got this lisp, and he acts very aristocratic and the way he thinks a nobleman should act. And he's kind of a little bit of a poser in that respect. But anyway, he ended up, as I was trying to incorporate this lisp and a little bit of an accent, ended up being this very, very flamboyant and like ostentatious nobleman who had these like grandiose visions of what he thinks his life should be and like how I mean, he's completely delusional, and it was just, it was a blast. If anybody doesn't follow the live sessions, I'd certainly encourage you to go back and listen to that live session beginning at about the 1 hour mark. There's a lot happens in that like kind of 15 minute period from then on, especially this character, and we all completely lost it laughing as several times during the conversation because it was just too funny. We really just couldn't handle it. So anyway, I'm hoping to bring him back at some point because he was just too much fun to be there.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious.
Well, let's we got a little bit of time left. I'd like to check in with the listeners. As always, you guys can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up at Twitter or on Twitter at Reckless Dice. Aaron Mokhtar, friend of the show, comments on the Reckless Dice podcast status update, and he had a couple bits that he was hoping we could discuss how we handle in-game. The first one being, how do you run social encounters?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's, I hesitate to say that there's only two camps of thought on this, but clearly I think for the purposes of directing conversation, I think there are generally considered to be sort of two general approaches to social encounters in role-playing games. You know, there's the people who say, you know, that social encounters should be, that's the realm of role-playing, that they should be role-played and they're, you know, no dice, you should talk like your character, you should say what your character says.
So if you're in that school and you want an example of how that can work effectively, I suggest going back and listening to that Von Tüchtenhagen segment, because that was, we didn't roll a single die during that entire encounter, and I felt everybody, I mean, there may as well have been dice rolling in the background as we were going, because the conversation was working back and forth, and I thought that was a perfect example of how it can work. But I'm very curious, because I think that's the hardest way, but also the most elegant way.
Right.
But the other school of thought, which I think you're about to get into, is the one where I think most of Aaron's question is going to lie.
Right, where we're talking about, you know, social encounters as kind of a character mechanism or as a game mechanism, sort of.
Yeah.
How do you use the rules effectively, and what do results mean, and how do you correlate a character's actions with the numbers on the dice and that sort of thing. It's tricky. I think really you can't just go with a blanket approach to every social encounter, even. The same way that, as it might sound maybe counterintuitive or might sound a little out of left field, but the same way I don't approach every combat encounter in exactly the same way or with exactly the same mindset, you know, and that not every combat encounter needs to be rolled out round for round, blow for blow. The same way I think social encounters, I don't think there's anything wrong with handling them by using your character's skills and talents. I mean, clearly, Warhammer 3rd Edition specifically gives you tools to have your character, you know, have sort of metagame meat, you know, as it were. You have teeth that you can use, you know, the rules against other characters in a social circumstance.
I find myself like as the conversation is going and the PCs or the GM want to force a point. So for example, they want to convince somebody to do something that the other player may not want to do, or they want to negotiate a better price, or those scenarios are where I find you transition from talking to, okay, make me such and such skill check or pull out such and such action card. I rarely have more than one or two roles in a social engagement. But the other way I've seen it handled successfully is you role play out the encounter and then roll a die at the end once the kind of final decision on your success has to be made. So you're talking with the noble, telling him all the reasons you should do something, and then ultimately you roll the die at the end just to let you know kind of how he reacts.
Right. I've been in several discussions with gamers on this topic of, should you roll dice, should you not roll dice, and, how much of your character is you and how much of your character is, your character. And I don't have a problem with rolling some dice, but I also want to, you want to encourage role play, right? So it just seems natural that, if you as a player happen to, be very convincing in an argument, then, you might throw your player a bone if they roll, they roll really badly. Well, you nudge them up a couple extra points because, they put their words together well, and they were very convincing in the role play portion, even though apparently, they were picking their nose while they were doing it or something, something that kind of, kind of flubbed it a bit. At the same or on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have the guy, the player, who is the very eloquent, silver-tongued, very glib type of guy who's playing the barbarian that's got, an intelligence of two, and he's got absolutely no social skills whatsoever, trying to say, that he is running... he's running circles around this nobleman in court. Well, yeah, no, probably not. So roll your, give me your fellowship test, and let's see how well you do. How much of what you as the player are conceiving is actually coming out of your character's mouth. And so I think there is room for using or for considering the character's potential versus the player's potential. And like you were saying, I think it really just comes down to circumstances where, of conflict, where you've got two different agendas maybe, and, obviously neither side of the conflict would willingly back down, but it's, a question of who is more effective at, either getting around or beating down the other.
I like to give the players who want to actually role play it out through conversation the chance to do that, and generally speaking, unless their argument makes no sense, that almost if they can do that and formulate a conversation that logically makes sense, that to me almost creates a success in my head, because they've gone through the effort of explaining it and convincing. If it's a convincing argument, that's a success. If it's a non-convincing argument, well, maybe not so much a success. It's for the players who don't want to do the first-person narrative or kind of saying, hey, my character is going to try and explain to the nobleman that this is our position and this is what he should do. That, to me, says, okay, make the roll.
Yeah. Well, that kind of is important from my personal point of view, because you as a player are not you're playing a character, and your character is not you. Your character has fundamentally separate experiences from you. The example I tend to use is, because for today's audience, it's one that's probably pretty easy to grasp, is if I'm playing a computer hacker. Now, I'm not a hacker. I know enough about computers to get by, but I don't know anything about modern programming languages. I don't know anything about server security. I don't know anything about firewalls. So me as a person, as a player, I know nothing about hacking. I couldn't tell you I couldn't tell you where you would start to hack a computer. Mm-hmm. But if I'm playing a character who knows, who's a very, he makes a living as a computer hacker, well, then I would expect that the game has some way to communicate some way for that character to appropriately interact with the world. And by, hey, I want to hack this computer, and, not having the GM say, okay, well, how are you going to hack the computer? Well, I don't know. How do you hack a computer? Shouldn't my character know? I think in social encounters, I think that's where the skills step in, is because, if you're playing, say, a character who is a nobleman, who is very accustomed to sort of the ins and outs of how you would speak to people, how you present yourself to people, the proper etiquette in court. If your character knows those, but you as a player don't necessarily know them, then it seems a little kind of illogical to assume that because you as a player make a faux pas, that your character would just totally, stick their foot in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you don't know any better.
Sure.
So
that's interesting. That brings up you kind of brought up the two points where one is what if I were to play, me personally, I think I would have a lot of trouble playing, a nobleman or a priestly character. Mm-hmm. I just don't know a lot about it. I mean, I know what I've read, but I'm not sure I could apply a lot of my personal knowledge to it to make it effective. And then the contrast to that would be my ogre character, which I'm looking forward to playing, is arguably really, really dumb. And I really enjoy being that investigator who kind of pieces puzzles together and makes all these logical, complex conclusions. And I'd have to really hold myself back from those kind of deductions and interactions, because the ogre can't jump up and be like, aha, I figured it out.
Eureka!
I found a stake.
Yeah. And I think really that lends, if you kind of can keep that in mind, both as a game master and as a player, that there's really kind of two pieces to the puzzle. I mean, there's you as the player playing the character, bringing some knowledge to that, but then there's also the character who has a fundamentally different experience than you as the player. There's a disconnect, in information there, and I think that there should be some leeway to allow those to be shored up by good role-playing assisting bad dice rolling, or by, good dice rolling assisting bad role-play.
Aaron has two other parts of his question. I think the second part, or the third part rather, is going to be rather quick. But the second one, how did you handle playing a game as a non-combat PC? I think this whole podcast is kind of about that to some degree.
Yeah.
Not this particular episode, but I mean the podcast in general.
And Warhammer specifically is very – this is kind of a very important question in Warhammer, ironically because of the opposite scenario that, what about playing Warhammer as a combat PC? Well, that means that your character is probably going to be getting into combat a lot, or is going to be pursuing combat a lot. And, of course, combat in Warhammer is not a very desirable thing. It's not all glamorous and glitzy.
Well, I think that's why people either gravitate towards it or away from it, because if you're going to be in combat, heck, I want to survive, so I'm going to play somebody who will live, or you play somebody who just doesn't want to have any part of it because you also want to live.
Yeah.
It's funny, somebody in the forums brought up, I think it was a new player to the forums brought up an interesting question, and he was saying, who's a tank? Who's a DPS? Who's the thief character? And initially, of course, everybody jumped down his throat saying, what are you doing? You're missing the whole point. But I think they did a little more eloquently than that. But a lot of people enter the game from an MMO perspective, or from a role-based perspective. So, my guy is a fighter. My goal is to fight. My guy is a healer. My goal is to heal the group. My guy is the thief. My goal is to disarm traps. My guy is the caster. I blow stuff up from far away.
Right.
And this guy was entering the game with that perspective, and couldn't quite figure out why all these careers weren't slotting into these clearly defined roles.
Right.
And I think this kind of plays into Aaron's point here, where there is really not such a thing as a non-combat PC. I mean, there are some who are certainly better at combat, but
everybody's kind of got these problems.
Yeah.
Everybody in Warhammer can wield a sword. They all do just as much damage as the next guy because the sword hurts.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think, honestly, that's one of the things that appeals to me about Warhammer is that, ironically, by being less attractive, less glamorous, combat actually makes non-combat PCs more important because in essence, unlike in some other role-playing games that do glorify the combat aspect, and I'm not going to say that there isn't that combat in Warhammer is ineffectual or not useful at all, because it certainly can be, and it can certainly be fun. In fact, I would say I would dare say that any role-playing game should have some amount of conflict in it, and physical conflict is obviously one of the quickest, easiest, dirtiest ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, because combat isn't really it's not something you rush into, that means that characters really need to look outside. They need to look beyond the reach of their sword arm and say, well, if I want to accomplish things, if I want my character to be able to do things, to grow, to learn things, to have adventures, what else do I need to do? What do I need to be? What kinds of abilities do I need to explore? What kind of skills should I pick up? What kinds of people should I be interacting with?
Well, let's also not forget that a big point or concept in Warhammer is that there's no reward for fighting.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
No reward whatsoever. I mean, there's very little loot in the game. There's no experience points to be had for slaying the bad guys. All you're doing is putting yourself in danger.
Yeah, the only reward would be, successfully overcoming the whatever's threatening you.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you, and again, there are plenty of sort of the guys who are built to do that, right? Like the troll slayers and the soldiers and the pit fighters.
Right.
But just as often, in fact, more often, you've got the types like the rat catcher or what is it like from old second edition? You've got chimney sweeps and you've got dung collectors and
which brings up the whole concept of unbalanced character classes. And I think it's there for that exact reason. It doesn't have to all be fair and even.
Yeah, and so even some of the traditionally combat intensive type characters, like the wizards, when somebody thinks wizard or spellcaster, specifically here kind of referring to Dungeons and Dragons, they think about somebody who's combat capable, right? I mean, obviously they don't have many hit points or whatever. They can't wear heavy armor, but in Dungeons and Dragons they still have their fireballs and they have their haste spells and their hold monster, hold person.
Mm-hmm.
They're generally geared for fighting. After a fashion. But when you look at wizards in Warhammer, there's really only one or two wizards, types of wizards, who are really any good at fighting at all. And the rest of them, magic isn't about being good at fighting in Warhammer. Magic itself is kind of, you have a type of magic, and that magic kind of goes in the direction that it naturally would go. And so you're not going to see celestial wizards in combat all the time, though they have a couple of spells that might be useful. You're not going to see, like the jade wizards are going to be wading into combat all the time, because that's just not what they really do. And the priests, too. It's one of the things that a lot of people give me who are new to Warhammer question me about. They say, well, how come every, priest in Warhammer doesn't have healing spells? Because, isn't that what the priest is supposed to do?
Right.
And no, there's one very specific type of priest who has healing spells. But,
and even those aren't that good.
Yeah, relative to other games, they're not going to, reattach limbs and, prevent your innards from spilling out. But, it's just kind of a different creature in Warhammer. And so kind of getting to this concept of non-combat PCs, honestly, most parties should have more non-combat PCs in them than combat PCs. Sometimes, if you do the random career roll-up, then sometimes it's going to, it's going to swing the other way, and that's fine, too. But I don't think there's anything wrong. In fact, Well, I just replaced a player in my current campaign, and he happens to have rolled up a soldier. So now I'm up to two combat PCs. But before, I really just had one guy. You know, I just had the pit fighter, who was the only one that really had any reasonable, you know, any decent combat skills. So that generally meant that, you know, if they got separated from the pit fighter, the other PCs were very anxious to avoid combat because they knew that they weren't going to come out of it very well. They always lament whenever the pit fighter ends up dragging them into fights, because then they usually are the ones that, you know, see the wrong side of it.
Sure.
So, you know, they see the repercussions more so than the pit fighter does, so, because they're just not built for it. But then he's there to kind of help them out too. So, I don't think there's anything wrong with not being not having combat heavy parties.
Yeah. If anything, I think it's encouraged. Yeah. But I think that'll close it up for this show of the Reckless Dice podcast. We'll answer some more questions and comments in our next episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks. If you enjoy the show, please show your support with a review on iTunes. And until next time, thanks for listening.